Blog Talk Radio.
September 2013, the 251st day of the year, and this is Masonic Home Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham, so thank you for coming and joining me again. I hope that the next hour or so will be entertaining and informative and provoke, stimulate the little gray cells. As Paro would say, it's been amazing here in southern Ontario. The weather is treating us very well, giving us just a slight hint of the fall to come. And the sun is returning here as it always has. I want to talk to you today about some things that I've been keeping on the shelf for a little while. And been tempting you with over the past couple of months. I'm going to dust off my copy of The Life of Montaigne, because I think it certainly warrants a review by all of us in terms of the overall development of and thinking. You know, what's going on with the order. Now today I wrote to the Precy for this, calling it the doing the small things right, and I put the question to you again to help me with understand: are we a fortress of solitude or shadows of what we once were? Can a man who feels masonry as part of his soul, his being, his existence, exist in a world with distractions of conflict, hubris, and greed? Where truth is a commodity and claim the fraternal goal is having fun. I'm having difficulty with the detail here, you can tell, brethren. Huh. Has complacency robbed us of our ability to reason by accepting such absurd notions? Are we not alive in a world of great contradiction? The few have abundance while the majority struggle to live. Advantage of one civilization does not revise the history of the world. We strive with primitive alliances, beliefs that impede change, side by side with commercial interests that rewrite ethics of convenience. Hubris and deceit test our belief daily. Yet some remain resolute that each day is opportunity. And yet what work goes on to make that more than supposition. Wrapped by guilt or committed to assisting the downtrodden, intoxicated by materialism, mankind may turn away from the have-nots, but they follow like shadows until acknowledged. What then is the true purpose of the ancient and accepted Masonic in this context? let's examine if the cloister is by design of a natural occurrence. For those fortunate enough to be initiated into the craft, he can assume privilege because we are exclusive, if that is in fact fuel for his ego. Or, having been reborn as a Mason, he realizes his life is commitment to serve. Not reborn in a way that's going to threaten or challenge the man's faith, but reborn in a manner of thinking. Can we achieve peaceful coexistence, or do we need one side or the other to prevail and end our misery? Can we live in this world of contrast? A gradual creepage through the cracks might describe the beautiful resilience of our fraternity, but are we able to feel the weight of such defining questions and define our goals as seeking fun? These are weighty matters. Our purpose to have fun defies belief, defies understanding for any serious thinker. There are some out there that will make the argument, and already are. Really? 400 or 500 years of history, and that's it? Fun. Let's see if we can just stretch that out a little bit. Find that, as I think, fun means contentment. Then the man of character is wealthy beyond measure when he has found contentment with what he has. This is my definition. If fun means contentment to you. The man of character is wealthy beyond measure when he's found contentment with what he has. Not so the man who cannot want what he has. This is where I'm talking about need and want. If what we want is what we need, then we have achieved a mighty step forward. The weight of the world is on us, the seriousness. And it seems to trivialize the very essence of the order to talk about this being fun. If I've worked very hard and I study very hard and I've been tested by the masters and they've taught me the skills that I need in order to survive and do well and to excel, then the work of the enjoyment happens when I can put down the tools and look at my work and not necessarily accept it as somebody else does, but to say, I've put in effort and it's worthwhile. And then I can put down the tools with other men who understand that point. And that to me is enjoyment. That's contentment. Whether it's fun, I don't know. But I think we've mixed up that. We've become a bit confused because over the years these words have had different meaning. I think not too long ago our day would have been spent struggling to find some means of survival. This is before the welfare state found that there was more reason to help people sustain their dignity as human beings, to reduce starvation, to protect people with, and to become a nation of laws, than there was to let people fall into the decline because they were unable to compete. The person blinded in a freak accident. The family, the mother and children left destitute because the wage-earning father was incarcerated for what? Political reasons. Okay, that's a bit of a stretch, isn't it? Or for some mishandling of money in business transaction. We have stepped quite a bit away from the memories of our forefathers, and at our own peril. That was then, and it still exists today. We still have these problems around us. We're a great deal more pious, I think, It's more widespread. Remember, in the day, in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, we were seeing pockets of resistance to the popular attitude, the dog-eat-dog type of attitude. Anyone that would think that this was a spontaneous development would be mistaken. This was gradual. Good people knew that helping their neighbor was a good idea. That's always been the case. That's the nature of mankind. We are exposed repeatedly to headlines about somebody that violated those norms, violated those beliefs in the most crass and ill-thought-out manner. So much are we exposed, is exposed to us through the media, that it is a simple mind can be left to believe that that's defining our culture, defining our world, and it isn't. At least not amongst people who have taken the obligations of a Freemason, who believe in something larger than that, something more important than that. Again, we remain, as Plato has often taught us, victims of and trapped in our own experience, unable to go beyond that, because it forces us out of our comfort zone. We don't want to do that, do we? We don't want to have to struggle with things that are fundamental to our understanding of the world, our stability, just in case, oh my goodness, we might be wrong. As Henry David Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. The superior man thinks always of virtue. The common man thinks of comfort. That's the Chinese philosopher Confucius. Fun being the point of this? In fact, when I was recently looking into definitions and reading some articles, I came across one that explained the translations of the term charity. And this writer was explaining that there was a time when it was a matter of perspective, that the term had more to do with the strengthening of relationship, agape, love, that is to exist between all mankind. It's safer to say that when we're talking about all mankind than it is to talk about that idea within the walls of a lodge. Because often it gets into the silliness of being unable to distinguish between the intellectual sense and the more salacious sense. But you think for yourself, and this is where I need your advice. Ralph Waldo Emerson tells us, when a man becomes a conformist, he is sacrificing the richness of independent thinking. Oh my, this is going to cause me no end of headaches because I'm writing a paper on the need for conformity that's expressed to our initiates when they walk through the door of a lodge. How do you balance that off? How does one maintain the richness of independent thinking and yet conform to ancient practices? Well, you'd have heard me talk about the motto of our lodge, Aude, Vide, Tace. Well, Aude, listen, but it means more than that. In the Latin, it also talks about listening to understand. There's a purpose to the listening. So we take our ancient brethren at their word and to examine the deeper meaning, then we're probably getting closer to the fullness of Freemasonry. A little bit, yeah, that makes sense. Give me some, give me your ideas on that, please. Now, I want to just brush up our thinking about ethics, if you don't mind. It's a beautiful day, and this will just be like somebody whispering to you. It's so that you can work it into your conversation. It's a you know, one of those little fun facts you can tell everybody that you meet. And I'm talking a bit about the variations on ethics. You know, we go about, I think it's a bit glib to say, oh, yeah, well, we're all ethical because we're within this order. And if you ask somebody what in the world that means, again, Jimmy Buffett has quite made a whole career of singing to the parrot heads, but the parrot heads amongst us will say, I don't know. Or they make something up. Well, ethics is like everything else. It has a palette to it. There's a number of different aspects to ethics, and I just want to talk to you about a little bit about normative ethics, and that's the study of ethical action. It is the branch of philosophical ethics that investigates the set of questions that arise when considering how one ought to act, morally speaking. Normative ethics is distinct from meta-ethics because it examines standards for the rightness and wrongness of actions. So most of us, when we think about ethics, that's what we're thinking about, normative ethics. Meta-ethics studies the meaning of moral language and the metaphysics of moral facts, the deeper meaning. Normative ethics is also distinct from descriptive ethics, as the latter is an empirical investigation of people's moral beliefs. And we'll talk a little bit more about what an empirical investigation is. Simply think about it. It's like bringing forward the evidence. To put it another way, descriptive ethics would be concerned with determining what proportion of people believe that killing is always wrong, while normative ethics is concerned with whether it is correct to hold such a belief. Hence, normative ethics is sometimes called prescriptive rather than descriptive. However, on certain versions of the meta-ethical view called moral realism, moral facts are both descriptive and prescriptive at the same time. It's not as simple as saying, yeah, I'm an ethical person. It's like saying, I guess, if I've got a pulse, yeah, I'm a human. That's what it takes to make me a human. And there you go. We've walked away from all of these discussions about character development, haven't we? Most important thing. So the part that I want to talk to you add a little bit is about Stoicism. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus posited the greatest good was contentment and serenity. Now, you've got to love this guy. Contentment and serenity. This is the man that probably didn't have the distillery, but he had the idea of a nice 16-year-old single malt. I could be wrong in there. That's a bit of speculation, but I tend to think it might have a point there, and some of you will. Certainly, I see through my magic mirror, I'm seeing you all nodding. Keep your hand on the wheel there if you're driving, listening to this. Peace of mind, or apatheia, was the highest value. Self-mastery over one's desires and emotions lead to spiritual peace. Oh, what he's whispering in our ear, boys, is get a grip on the temper and attitude. It's simple. If you want spiritual peace, this is where they're just laying it out as blunt can be. It makes us seem like we're maybe not as quick as we like to think when we're told these things, and yet we can just blindly go around ignoring them. Get a grip, self-mastery over one's desires. So something like this, tell me, am I wrong here? I want to prove that I'm a genius and you're not. So everything that you say is wrong and everything that I say is right. Sorry, I can't even say that with a straight face around here. God. But it's saying you get some control over desire. Now, you decide within the reaches of your own mind the depth of desire and what it means to you. Is it like people that treat their God like Santa Claus? Oh, you know, I'll negotiate with you. I'll cut this deal. If you give me this one, I will do wonderful things for you forever. I'll be a changed person. Okay, that's a particular version of God, but it's also a reflection of something else that's not so flattering about the character of the person that would do that. And yet we see that constantly. So I guess there's times when I would say, open the eyes, and I want to look into those eyes, and I want you to tell me that God is there to negotiate and just give me stuff, and I'll deal. We'll make a deal. You know, he's a trader. There, I've seen the light. Until next time, and give me something here. You know, give me this one. And I think it's a lot more in depth than that. The unconquerable will is central to this philosophy of Stoicism. The individual's will should be independent and inviolate. That's you and me. Independent and inviolate. I think I'm getting afraid here, brethren. I think what he's getting at is I should know my own mind. I should have control over my emotions so I'm not walking around ranting. And I'm more considerate of the world around me. This is frightening now. This means I'm going to I can see where this is going. It's where this is leading is I'm going to be held responsible for myself, my own actions. There's consequences. Oh, I don't know if I can't go through this. Allowing a person to disturb the mental equilibrium is, in essence, offering yourself in slavery. Whoa. Now, what Epictetus is telling us is that it's my choice. I allow somebody else to upset me. Boy, there's some people I know with quick tempers that are really not going to be very comfortable with this at all because they can blame their attitudes on anything, everything, except to realize that it's their choice. If a person is free to anger you at will, you have no control over your internal world and therefore no freedom. If a person is free to anger you, freedom from material attachments is also necessary. If a thing breaks, the person should not be upset, but realize it was a thing that could break. Similarly, if someone should die, then those close to them should hold to their serenity because the loved one was made of flesh and blood, destined to death. Stoic philosophy says to accept things that cannot be changed, resigning oneself to existence and enduring in a rational fashion, death is not feared. People do not lose their life, but instead return, for they are returning to God who initially gave what the person is as a person. Hard to argue that one. Well, I'm... Man, did I put my foot into that? Garcia here argues that Epictetus said difficult problems in life should not be avoided, but rather embraced. I like this boy. I really do. Problems, how you avoid them. You end up doing what? Walking around buttoned down and stiff and rigid as if, oh my goodness, any problem that occurs is a reflection on me. Well, of course, it is always about me. The ego. It's always about you. It's always the ego, isn't it? I mean, he's saying, get over yourself. Problems are a way of thinking, and we need to be able to embrace them. And of course, you've heard me talk about the need to learn from our mistakes. Of course, if we don't, we're destined to be stuck. They are spiritual exercises needed for the health of the spirit, just as physical exercises required for the health of the body. He also stated that sex and sexual desire are to be avoided as the greatest threat to the integrity and equilibrium of a man's mind. This is really getting interesting, isn't it? Because it gets into this whole notion of how that affected certain religious practices. Abstinence is highly desirable. Yeah, you're losing me, Epictetus. Epictetus said remaining abstinent in the face of temptation was a victory for which a man could be proud. So here, he's really telling us that you go back and think about earlier. This is not a man that's being proscriptive here, right? Because he said earlier that the individual's will should be independent and inviolate. So reason through what this fellow is saying. If in that moment of, we're talking about the difference between desire and lust. Well, let's sit down in the locker room like we're 12-year-olds and talk and have this discussion. Except I'm not 12 years old anymore. He's right. Lust can happen for different reasons, and it rarely ends up well. And it's that intoxication, that little part of our mind that seems to drive us to the point of madness if it's not satiated somehow. Losing control? There you go. So we take today, we look at this, and we need to think about it in the context of our own lives. Allowing a person to disturb the mental equilibrium is, in essence, offering yourself in slavery. So at the end here, examine your own reaction. Your reaction demonstrates whether you are free or not, whether you're trapped. There you go. That's a nice... Oh, I know I'm feeling better here. It's true, though. Something to be said. We'd be fools not to pay attention to some of the bright things that are said around us, eh? Just think about it. Just quote that first paragraph from Kipling's poem that hangs on my good friend David's wall. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. There. We're an interesting group. We can have we need to be able to have some heady discussions, thoughtful discussions. This is the drift, I think, that it has happened in Freemasonry, and going to be talking more about this over in London in November, paper I'm doing on the evolution of Freemasonry, and I think we have I don't think it's scandalous, but you know, bear in mind this, what I've just been reading what we've just been going through about Stoicism. The idea that we've evolved into a social service type of organization because of the influences, the passage of time, when these concepts were coming to fruition. The idea of a service and reform, social reform, was much different in people's minds than it is today. In order for us to make connections, we read through centuries of history and find the workings, obscure workings, of great thinkers. This wasn't the attitude of the average person on the street. And decade by decade, century by century, we're able to accumulate the work of great minds. That doesn't necessarily mean that everything, if we generalize, everything in the past was affected by those great ideas. It simply doesn't. It simply means that we have this distillation available to us today, all the wonderful ideas put together, and we can put them together in a compendium. And if we're truly naive, it's not like we're putting together the 6 o'clock news. This is where there's space in between these bits of history and this development. Space that's really important, time that's really important. So a group that we're offering protection for my family and for myself if and when there was need would be something striking in the day. a group that was being initiated by truly influential people, influential both in terms of their scientific genius and their social rank. Well, here in Canada, we have a hard time with these questions, even to this day, 2013. We don't have the stability of the aristocracy to fall back on. Aristocracy is a very, very interesting term as it relates to the likes of me. And I suppose we can trace back to, we can trace back into the Graham clan history to find out when we did have opportunity to hold rank in Scotland. But today that's been diluted, except for some that want to cling. As my friend John often says, everybody likes to feel special. So some people feel special because of things that happened hundreds of years ago. That's all you got? Sorry. Because the people that I experience are contemporaries of mine and yours. So I guess we have to think about the influences that pull these ideas together. And it was brilliant that they did. Over the past 150 years, we have seen our acceleration of ideas. The amount of information that we've been able to generate and to distribute has, by comparison, began moving at an accelerated and ever accelerating pace, to the point where 200 years ago, you and I might have been having difficulty discovering that somebody had written Darwin had released his paper back in the 19th century. Then, we may not know that. We may not know that for some time, and because the media wasn't developed. So that kind of information would have had to have been carried somehow, conveyed somehow. Either we were advantaged and of a learned society, that's one way, or we were associates of people that had sufficient rank and means to travel, that cross-pollination that went on between nations that became ever so important. But that was a very narrow group of people. When you think about the larger populations who were going about their business, very invested in their daily survival. So over the past couple of years, the past 100 years, we've been influenced by this idea of service because we don't have rank to fall back on. We don't have the scientists to fall back on. That group is still, the academics amongst us, is still a very small proportion of our society, as it was even in the day. I remember one of the things that became a cause of intrusion was when people were able, through commerce, through trade, to acquire wealth. And wealth enabled a great many people to acquire the material expression of rank, social rank, the large house, the artwork, access to theater, to literature, the libraries. So this, even in the day, we saw, and not too long ago, we've seen the gentry really wrestling with this idea of these upstarts, these people without breeding, that without provenance, you cut them, they bled red instead of blue, encroaching in a way into the display of power. The display of power can be exercised without abandon today. Conspicuous consumption was what the sociologists identified. That has moved to a point where people are now unable to afford the material expression of their position, but craving it. So everybody is living on a time payment in a way. When you drive past the Bentley sports car, make no mistake, the likelihood of the person owning it in the sense that my grandfather would mean it is very, very slim. Creates a great impression, doesn't it? Until you weigh in with that notion that perhaps there's an element of superficial materialism being expressed here. Now, I like the contours of a well-built machine. But I also live in a world where novelty has taken over permanence. The things that I have around me aren't built to become better with age. My fountain pen, the nib would start to wear to fit my signature and my script. Not so a ballpoint pen that I throw out whenever it becomes dry. There's no patina on the things that I buy. The leather doesn't age and give off that rich smell. There's no leather around me. It's faux leather, faux fur. We've evolved that way. The lodges function that way. Many, many lodges do. But I think the link, I think it's called a linchpin, isn't it? The link, Masonic link, is something that has always been available to us every single day. But it's uncomfortable to say we need to be able to live, we need to be able to have the advantages of the exceptionally wealthy of the 18th century. Now, this becomes tremendously absurd in a way, because only the very powerful and perhaps the royals would have access to symphony music. And remember the scandal of Shakespeare bringing theater to the rabble. And we can see later, in hindsight, the benefits. So now, whether a fellow has a nickel in his pocket or not, literally, he can appreciate Verdi or Puccini or the writings of great poets. We have access through the philanthropy of Americans, like Carnegie, who planted libraries in communities across North America. There's one less than a quarter of a mile from where I'm sitting. Access to knowledge. Ah, there's the rub, huh? Do we value knowledge today the way it was valued in the past? Do we have that panic that is in the hearts of families in desperate situation? Desperate that their oldest child gets an education that gives the child and everybody else access to a better way of living. We tend to call it immigration. It's access to opportunity. That access pales. You and I aren't talking about struggling for a cup of coffee. And if any of you are, let me know. We can help you if you're struggling like that. I'm talking about the struggle for intellectual freedom. And not even to be afraid of using words like that. Because the term the term has become synonymous with snobbery. Well, I take great offense with that, because the simple men that have influenced me, the proud men that have influenced me, my family members, knew how to read, knew how to think, knew how to process ideas, were ethical people. They'd all read the Bible and had an understanding of it for themselves. They were devout in their own way, on their own terms, let me put it that way. They were subjected to whatever nature would dish out to them. I don't think those facts of those influences have left us. We've not been abandoned. But that craving for information may have been replaced, and I think it has. Our initiates become a source, become a revenue stream. We ply them with notions that our whole purpose is fun. And when we see that quizzical look on their face, that puzzled, confused look, that everything they've read has explained that they're walking into an enriched intellectual, philosophical environment where thoughtful discussion will bring, make access, bring great ideas, make great ideas accessible to them. And what did they get? A slice of pizza, a beer, a barbecue, a dance. Keep it in context. I'm not saying this. Well, maybe I'm speaking a little more with impunity today because I'm respecting that you may have be challenged by Epictetus. Get control of your desire. Don't let me provoke your temper. That's you. That's your choice. But I'm not being intentionally provocative here. I'm trying to sort out these ideas. Something has happened, and we seem to be preoccupied with the 6 o'clock news about masonry. Well, the 6 o'clock news is about accidents and burnings and inconvenience and tragedy and decay and decline. That's the 6 o'clock news. Ridiculing the suffering or the discomfort of other people. I don't want to see that. I don't find that news. Some young starlet has succumbed to the pressures. I don't want to mock her. I have no business doing that. I don't want to be there during her court processes. I don't want to be there when she's coming out of rehab. Those are her private moments. But our appetite for celebrity has made us obese. It's made us slow. It's made us sluggish. So that table is never going to be laid bare. I say this because those influences are very powerful. We can't control the larder, but we can control our appetite and what we choose to eat. So if we choose an intellectually healthy meal, Freemasonry will give us that opportunity. No wonder our initiates are finding disillusion, walking away. No wonder. It's not a failing. It's a matter of getting around to it and understanding. This isn't about failing. It's like new ways of thinking about old ideas. We haven't failed. It's like we haven't gotten around to it, and now we do. Now what do you do? Do you begin to live the transparent, centered life of a man in control of his desires and emotion? Or do you live ready to criticize at everything that doesn't fit with our narrow version of the world, especially if we can criticize somebody that has disadvantage, like a young person, that makes us feel so, it must make us feel so powerful to be able to ridicule the newness. Everything new is wrong, everything old is good. Well, think about how that makes a young man feel. And besides, it's not true. Because we can't separate out whether somebody's saying that because of their personality or their temperament. There is a difference. Oh, let me go on here. I want to talk to you. Can I? Come on. Give me some ideas about, what do I know, huh? What do I know? I know when I'm seeing things that don't make sense, and I'm thinking, gee, I want to get control of these recruiters. I really do. One day I want to see that a lodge will take this entry point so important that they will have their very best, and there will only be, and that will be handled consistently. In other words, I may not be the one chosen by the lodge to handle applications. That may go to somebody else. This claim that every one of us can produce candidates, I think applicants, I think is part of the problem. It's a big part of the problem. We are not protecting the West Gate. We have to be more careful about who we're letting in. Because it's not about whether we're letting in some scoundrel. We've got work to do to create the kind of atmosphere that's going to help develop Masonic thought. And personally, I think we're functioning about 30% of the cylinders are working. Do you want to hear a little bit about how ritual may have developed? I'll give you an idea here. This is from a writer, Neville Cryer. If you Google him, you'll see a lot of it. It's quite good. It's interesting. It's a short little piece, but he's talking about how, that connection with the guilds. And we've been back and forth about that a few times on Masonic Home Companion. He considers the origin of Masonic ritual in guild mystery plays. Let me just talk to you a little bit about this. Not long ago, the chapter of York Minster, the governing body of the cathedral, decided that the time had come to replace the stonework around the arch over the main west doorway. The figures that were originally carved there had slowly worn away. The scenes to the newly carved included the Garden of Eden, the story of Cain and Abel, the dramas of Noah and Jonah, as well as three scenes of Our Lord and St. Peter. To achieve this end, the clergy and the architect agreed on the subjects and the drawings to be made. Then the stonemasons in the Minster workyard were informed and asked to execute the carvings required. This is, I am sure, exactly what must have happened in medieval days. The builders and stonemasons would have been fully aware of what it was they had to produce, even if we are in part mystified by what they carved. Some of the symbolism may be wholly lost on us, but you may be sure it was well understood by those who carved it. The masons were aware of their work and its contribution to the education of the public who would see it, and were also fully aware of their need to share in the life of the local community. Their guild, with those of other crafts, formed the basis of town or city government, and this sense of communal involvement is what led them to take part in the annual public procession of Corpus Christi plays in June. This mobile performance of plays during one whole day took place in cities as far apart as Newcastle, York, Wakefield, Norwich, Coventry, Exeter, and Chester. Countrywide, in fact, and the performances continued for over 250 years. From just after 1300 to about 1575, a sizable slice of English history. In each city, there were two lists, one of the plays to be performed and another of the guilds in their local order of importance. This latter order differed. In Chester and Norwich, the most important guilds were those of the drapers and haberdashers, whilst in York, it was the barber surgeons. Whatever the order, the guilds made their choice of which play they would each present according to the local order. Once their choice was made, the play was the one that, which they would probably perform for year after year, unless there was a change in the ranking of the local guilds, or if a guild specially requested permission to change their play, as the York Masons did in 1431. What must be emphasized is that even as with the Masons, a guild was one of the lesser ones and thus had a more limited choice after several others had decided. Great care was still taken over the kind of play because not only was the symbolism of the play important, as with their stone carving, but the cost of the performance was substantial. In present-day values, the initial outlay would be up to £4,000, with an annual upkeep of £1,000. Each guild wanted a play which related to its own patron saint. The Masons preferred plays involving either the Virgin Mary or the two St. Johns. The other requisite was that the content of the play needed to relate to the particular craft which presented it. The barber surgeons preferred plays showing the fine beads of St. John the Baptist or the Jewish priests, while the watermen chose plays about Noah's Ark or Jonah and the whale. The Masons wanted plays about the temple, David and Solomon, the Virgin Mary, Jesus, stones, or the death of the innocent. The latter referring to the ancient builder's legend that a suitable victim had to be slain and laid in the foundations before a building could be safely erected. What they chose is relevant to several degrees known in York in the 18th century. Here, I'll just give you a little bit of a list of the towns. In Aberdeen, it was the Massacre of the Innocents. In Beverley, the Temptation of Jesus on the Pinnacle of the Temple. In Chester, the Massacre of the Innocents. In Coventry, the Three Marys at the Tomb of Jesus when the stone rolled away. In Dublin, Moses causing Pharaoh's host to be lost in the Red Sea. Newcastle, the Burial of the Virgin Mary. Norwich, Cain murdering his brother Abel. In Wakefield, the child Jesus presented to the temple, or Cain murdering Abel. And in York, the ancient city, the burial of the Virgin Mary, or the coming of the Magi, and the massacre of the innocents, or Jesus' presentation in the temple. The plays were composed in verse, and the words learnt by heart, since the participants might be unable to read. Several fines were imposed for disgracing the company by failing to recite the words correctly. In addition, the verses were accompanied by formal gestures because the public, also largely illiterate, were used to the formal gestures employed by the clergy during Mass. Objects were used which acquired symbolic meanings. Pointed hats signified Jews. Mitres represented high priests. Staves denoted prophets, and a cluster of candles was a star. Pots represented manna or incense, and robes of specially chosen colors were used. If you want to find Solomon or David on the roof of our older churches or cathedrals, you simply look for a figure holding a model temple or a harp. Is it any wonder that from those plays, men and women received impressions that persist nearly 700 years later? Impressions that have gone very deep and affected our whole culture. The idea that God is an old man with a beard sitting on a cloud, that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John surround one's bed, that hell is a blazing furnace with red horned devils brandishing forks, that angels have blonde hair, white robes, and huge wings, that the Virgin Mary wears blue and has a halo of stars. The complete list is much longer. If seeing the plays was able to do so, was able to so deeply impress the minds of the audience and their descendants, what might it have done to those who planned and produced the plays they memorized? Furthermore, the clergy attached to the guilds, those who read the books which colored the contents of the play, were as influential in affecting the city craftsmen as the monks of the monasteries had been in guiding the masons whom they employed. I have no hesitation in asserting that, contrary to what some have claimed were the uninteresting practices of the late medieval masons, these men had a dramatic background knowledge to draw on. The operative masons were likely over time to wield into their traditions the words, symbols, and gestures which they had so regularly displayed in their plays. While these operatives were joined or replaced by the new speculatives who, as products of the new Tudor grammar schools, were now able to read and write, then the old form of the lodge and its acquired traditions could begin to be altered. Through these new and accepted Freemasons, the new guild lodges could be shaped, slowly but steadily, into a style more familiar to us, and the proceedings of that kind of lodge would begin to be not play acting, but ritual. A period of transition. It is impossible to explain briefly the transition in dramatic presentation following the late 1500s, when many of the mystery plays ceased to be regularly staged. In York, this end came in 1572. However, some places continued them until about 1620. Even so, three points are relevant to note. Some 50 new plays based on biblical themes were produced between 1550 and the arrival of King James I in 1603. The subjects include Moses, Gideon, Jephthah, King Hiram of Tyre. In 1560, there was a special play called The Wisdom of Solomon, which ended with the Queen of Sheba arriving at Solomon's court to admire the completion of the temple. The Globe Theatre in London was designed to be erected as a form of sacred temple of the octagon shape of what was then thought to be the form of the Holy Sepulchre. You know the sepulchre, yeah. Here, the plays of Shakespeare were staged still using verse with formal gestures, symbolic dress, and symbolic objects. Masons like Inigo Jones and Nicholas Stone were asked to construct buildings in Stuart times based on the work of an architect called Serlio, whose main contribution had been the construction of the perspective stages of the Roman theater. Inigo Jones, the designer of the Whitehall Banqueting Hall, which was erected for royal stage entertainments, became, with colleagues, the creator of masks and costume dramas. A presentation of Solomon and Sheba took place in 1607. We can conclude that even though guild plays were discontinued by 1580, the number of biblical themes available was actually increased. The introduction of the Geneva or Breeches Bible in 1560 introduced clear links with our present ritual. The Freemasons' links with dramatic presentations were clearly continued, and revived knowledge about ancient forms of architecture was being acquired. The Commonwealth period saw a ban on theaters, a limit on large house building, and an attack on traditional beliefs and practices. But it only lasted for 20 years, and many people hung on, all the more tenaciously, to what they prized from the past. Man, they sound like you and I. It was followed by the Restoration. Ideas and customs that had been disallowed burst forth, and we come to this fresh age of rebuilding with Palladian and Vitruvian-style stone dwellings that also made use of Roman stage designs. And it saw the emergence of what we can begin to call Masonic ritual. What do we find when anything resembling our present practice appears? Ritual in verse, standard biblical themes, no printed or published texts, memory learning still required, specific gestures, symbolic items, almost a complete rerun of where the mystery plays left off. Only now, not performed on an open wagon and in the street, but on a tavern or private house floor, and in a rear or upper room. I would dare to claim that we have come from role play to ritual. Ha! Huh. The Reverend Neville Barker Crier, formerly served as Grand Chaplain, Assistant Provincial Grand Master of Surrey, and the Master of Quattro Coronati Lodge, number 2076. He was Prestonian Lecturer in 1974, the Betham Lecturer in 1996 to 98, and author of many books, including Masonic Halls of England, The Arch and the Rainbow, and I Just Didn't Know That. Until his retirement, he was the General Director of the British and Foreign Bible Society. That's from material I've done around about 1993 or so, right? Does it begin to make a link? It certainly does. And do we have to think that is this kind of history thinking today outside the box? Well, we can begin to wonder at the content of the ritual, but what this is doing is say, why ritual? Well, it's also showing us that there was continuity. A great deal of continuity. Now we're scooting into the last part of the show, and how am I doing so far? Still, if I hear snoring out there, then I've served a wake up, yes. It's good to have you there with me. Keeps me awake, keeps me on my toes, eh? Ah, dear me. Here's what Bertrand Russell said, interesting guy. One should respect public opinion in so far as is necessary to avoid starvation and to keep out of prison. Ah, Bertie. But anything that goes beyond this is voluntary submission to an unnecessary tyranny and is likely to interfere with happiness in all kinds of ways. Oh, Emerson, real men don't conform to the beliefs of others, even when society has concluded on what is good and true, but maintain the integrity of their own mind. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So I won't say, it's not for me to say whether there's fools inside of lodges. That would be impolite. But Voltaire told us, every man is the creature of the age in which he lives. Very few are able to raise themselves above the ideas of the times. Well, gentlemen, you are part of the very few. That's what you're expected to do. Raise yourself above the ideas of the times. None are more helplessly enslaved than those who falselessly believe they are free. We have work to do. Well, how am I doing so far? Just a little bit on history. You okay about history? A bit about the constitutions here. I think it's kind of interesting. I do. Freemasons are certainly more interested in what is happening in the world today than in the ancient origins of their craft. Oh, ain't that the truth? Let's order a pizza and have some beer. Let's not get too wordy. And we don't want any of those words with more than two syllables. I'm sorry, it's a bit frustrating because when I sit down with all of you, with any of you, the conversation is enormously thoughtful. But put us together in a group, what in the world happens? I just don't understand that. It's almost like we become very self-conscious and embarrassed about being able to talk about an idea. And my goodness, how many times have you heard somebody say something that, he's sort of pushing things a little, pushing an idea out there so he can get a reaction, and people get angry. Like, grow up. How are we supposed to progress if that's the limit? Everything is limited by the lack of control over our emotion collectively. We have got to demonstrate better. And I don't know if it's enough to say, well, just do it by example. The example needs to be to put some limits and controls on this. Did I hear that there were fines if you screwed up your memory work, that you would receive a fine when you're doing the mystery play? Well, I don't know. Is that really underlining just how important it is? Well, yeah, but instead of thinking about the greater good, that inferior work and somebody just blowing their lines, I don't mean forgetting something where they obviously have it all committed, but somebody that you can tell has just not done the work. Well, you're letting down the entire group. You're not letting, it's not about the individual. Oh, that poor fellow, he's so anxious. It's not about him. It's about the lodge, presenting ritual. And if we've turned that away, if we've turned away from the importance of dealing with the protecting the interests of our lodge, then all we're doing is we're stroking the egos of individuals. Now that is a sorry state of evolution. So we need to be able to talk about it, identify it. Is it there? I think so. Go and see. If I'm completely wrong, tell me. Please, by all means. But keep it focused on the solution. The solution, I believe, in my heart, is awareness. Not to walk around with a big stick. It's awareness. I would rather be in your company if we can have that kind of conversation. And you know it's not going to be tedious and lengthy. We'll be able to have a laugh and share a drink and relax a bit. But that, when I think about sitting down with you, the first thing that comes isn't that I'm going to sit down and have fun. I'm going to sit down and have a meaningful conversation with you, that I'm going to want to see you, that you're interesting, that you're on top of things, that you've been reading something, you have something to share, you've been thinking about something and you have something to share, or that you're arguing with something that I say, you disagree, that's wonderful. That's what creates the appeal. Not somebody making these snide, glib comments I have to tolerate, and I don't think that I think it has a destructive influence on new boys. It makes us seem silly. Freemasons are certainly more interested in what is happening in the world today than in the ancient origins of their craft. But a study of how Freemasonry has evolved over more than 400 years does provide a fascinating insight into how Masonic structure and practice have been shaped by society, and how society in its turn has been shaped by Freemasonry. We live in an increasingly secular age where spiritual aspirations are more and more being set aside. It was not always so, and Freemasonry by its history can claim to show us a more considerate, more caring era in the world's history, when harmony and the insights of the human heart were promoted more than they are today. Nobody can say with certainty how Freemasonry came into existence, but that is not to say that we have lost the thread of its history, a very rich history. The story of the many men, some prominent in society and some not so well known, who have illustrated Masonic precepts by their lives and their examples, would fill several large tomes. The events in history in which Freemasons have played a part directly or indirectly are too numerous to catalog. So in this section, we have assembled articles dealing with subjects diverse as Christopher Wren, Rosalind Chapel, a murder trial involving Freemasons, a prominent Masonic photographer, the Spanish Civil War, Freemasons in the Gold Rush of the Yukon, French Freemasonry in the Resistance, and the Freemasons in the Mounties. We'll get around to them, don't you worry. Once we delve into the known history of Freemasonry, we should perhaps not be surprised to learn that many of the most prominent architects in London in the Age of Enlightenment were Freemasons. Nicholas Stone, Inigo Jones, Nicholas Hawksmoor, and possibly Christopher Wren himself. Possibly causes me a little bit. That's like, you know, possibly James Anderson. the Scots Presbyterian that developed the first constitution possibly was a Mason, but we don't have any record of it. Some aspect, Wren, I think, is a genius. Some aspects, if he wasn't, he should have been. Some aspects of Masonic history have a distinct flavor of having been contrived. Rosalind Chapel is a case in point, yet it is too rich and fascinating symbolism to ignore. Amen to that. Just sit there. Even the dampness seems to fit. Then again, we learn that Mozart's music was influenced by Freemasonry, and he, in turn, composed music for Freemasons. The last piece he wrote, he completed, was To a Lodge. We'll get there. Henry Welcome, who has given his name to the Welcome Institute for the History of Medicine, brought tolerance and philanthropy to bear on his business and on his research. In areas of conflict, we see the influence and example of Masonic principles. The part played by Freemasons in the French Resistance was not inconsiderable. And many Freemasons in many countries lost their lives defending liberal ideas, not least in the Spanish Civil War. While it has not been possible to cover the whole range of subjects included in Masonic history, we gain here an insight into how history and Freemasonry have often been fellow travelers along the way of life. We'll come back to those topics. Just examine them. Try to examine them in a light that's a bit objective, okay? Everything that we see popping up that's claimed to be... I actually saw somebody using a square and compasses as sort of a brand. Now, I know that's frowned upon, and I know he's likely to get himself a bit of stick over that. But it's like, think about it. Somebody would actually do that. Like, that's, we have failed to get the lessons out there, gentlemen. Well, there's hope. We're hope springs eternal here, huh? Say how to get on well with people. I just want to, you know, I did talk a little bit about Epictetus. We'll get back into, you know, the different aspects of ethics. If Masonic Companion can provide you with a bit of that information, then we've done something useful here. And from your responses over the years, I think that, you know, we're being encouraged. So if you can tune out, if you have enough depth of character right now, you don't want to hear more. How to get on well with people, how to deal with violence, how to adjust to losing somebody you love. Such questions arise in most people's lives. They are all versions of a bigger question. How do you live? How do you do the good or honorable thing while flourishing and feeling happy? This question obsessed Renaissance writers, none more than Michel Ecuyem de Montaigne. He was born in 1533 and he died in, you know, he died in, it's about my age, shit, 1592. Perhaps the first truly modern individual. A nobleman, public official, and wine grower, I like him, he wrote free-roaming explorations of his thought and experience, unlike anything written before. Get that? He was the first. He called them essays, meaning attempts or tries. Into them he put whatever was in his head, his tastes in wine and food, his childhood memories, the way his dog's ears twitched when it was dreaming, as well as the appalling events of this religious civil wars raging around him. The Essays was an instant bestseller, and over 400 years later, Montaigne's honesty and charm still draw people to him. Readers come in search of companionship, wisdom, and entertainment, and in search of themselves. It was like he was writing to us, wasn't it? So I'm going to get into some material about the full life of Montaigne. There's his biography has been written about over and over and over and over and over and over again. It traces his bizarre upbringing. Do you know he was made when he was a little kid? He was made to speak only Latin. Yeah. Interesting, eh? Youthful career, sexual adventures, travels, friendships with the scholar and poet Étienne de la Boétie and his adopted daughter, Marie de Gonnet. And as we know, Montaigne is an inexhaustible source of answers to the haunting question, how to live. Here's how it goes. The 21st century is full of people who are full of themselves. Unfortunately so. A half hour's trawl through the online ocean of blogs, tweets, tubes, spaces, faces, pages, and pods brings up thousands of individuals fascinated by their own personalities and shouting for attention. They go on about themselves, they diatribe and chat and upload photographs of everything they do. Uninhibitedly extrovert, they also look inward as never before. Even as bloggers and networkers delve into their private experience, they communicate with their fellow humans in a shared festival of the self. Some optimists have tried to make this global meeting of minds the basis for a new approach to international relations. The historian Theodore Zeldin has founded a site called the Oxford Muse, which encourages people to put together brief self-portraits in words describing their everyday lives and the things they have learned. They upload these for other people to read and respond to. For Zeldin, shared self-revelation is the best way to develop trust and cooperation around the planet, replacing national stereotypes with real people. The great adventure of our epoch, he says, is to discover who inhabits the world, one individual at a time. The Oxford Muse is thus full of personal essays or interviews with titles like Why an Educated Russian Works as a Cleaner in Oxford, Why Being a Hairdresser Satisfies the Need for Perfection, How Writing a Self-Portrait Shows You Are Not Who You Thought You Were, What You Can Discover If You Do Not Drink or Dance. By describing what makes them different from anyone else, the contributors reveal what they share with everyone else, the experience of being human. This idea, writing about oneself to create a mirror in which other people recognize their own humanity, has not existed forever. It had to be invented. And unlike many cultural inventions, it can be traced to a single person, Michel Equiem de Montaigne. A nobleman, a government official, and wine grower who lived in the Périgueux area of southwestern France from 1533 to 1592. Montaigne created this idea simply by doing it. And like most memorists of his day, he did not write or record his own deeds or achievements, nor did he lay down a straight eyewitness account of historical events. Although he could have done, he lived through a religious civil war which almost destroyed his country over the decades he spent incubating and writing his book. A member of a generation robbed of the hopeful idealism enjoyed by his father's contemporaries, he adjusted to public miseries by focusing his attention on private life. He weathered the disorder, oversaw his estate, assessed court cases as magistrate, and administered Bordeaux as the most easygoing mayor in its history. All the time, he wrote exploratory self-floating pieces to which he gave simple titles of friendship, of cannibals, of the custom of wearing clothes, how we cry and laugh for the same thing, of names, of smells, of cruelty, of thumbs, how our mind hinders itself, of diversion, of coaches, of experience, Although he wrote 107 such essays, some occupy a page or two, others are much longer, so that most editions of the complete collection run to over 1,000 pages. They rarely offer to explain or teach anything. Bataille presents himself as someone who jotted down whatever was going through his head when he picked up his pen, capturing encounters and states of mind as they happened. He used these experiences as the basis for asking himself questions about all the big questions that fascinated him, as it did many of his contemporaries. Although it is not quite grammatical in English, it can be phrased in three simple words: how to live. This is not the same as the ethical question, how should one live? Moral dilemmas interested Montaigne, but he was less interested in what people ought to have to do than what they actually did. He wanted to know how to live a good life, meaning a correct or honorable life, but also a fully human, satisfying, flourishing one. This question drove him both to write and to read, for he was curious about all human lives, past and present. And he wondered constantly about the emotions and motives behind what people did. And since he was the example closest to hand of a human going about its business, he wondered just as much about himself. A down-to-earth question, how to live, splintered into a myriad other pragmatic questions. Like everyone else, Montaigne ran up against the major perplexities of existence. How to cope with the fear of death? How to get over losing a child or a loved one? How to reconcile yourself to failures? How to make the most of every moment so that life does not drain away unappreciated? But there were smaller puzzles too. How do you avoid being drawn into a pointless argument with your wife or a servant? How can you reassure a friend who thinks a witch has cast a spell on him? How do you cheer up a weeping neighbor? How do you guard your home? What is the best strategy if you are held up by armed robbers who seem to be uncertain whether to kill you or hold you for ransom? If you overhear your daughter's governess teaching her something you think is wrong, is it wise to intervene? How do you deal with a bully? What do you say to your dog when it wants to go out and play while you want to stay at your desk writing your book? In place of abstract answers, Montaigne tells us what he did in each case and what it felt like when he was doing it. He provides all the details we need to make it real, and sometimes more than we need. He tells us, for no particular reason, that the only fruit he likes is melon, that he prefers to have sex lying down rather than standing up, that he cannot sing, and that he loves vivacious company and often gets carried away by the spark of repartee. But he also describes sensations that are harder to capture in words or even to be aware of. What it feels like to be lazy or courageous or indecisive, or to indulge a moment of vanity, or to try and shake off an obsessive fear. He even writes about the sheer feeling of being alive. Exploring such phenomena over 20 years, Montaigne questioned himself again and again and built up a picture of himself, a self-portrait in constant motion, so vivid that it practically gets up off the page and sits down next to you to read over your shoulder. He can say surprising things. A lot has changed since Montaigne was born, almost half a millennium ago. And neither manners nor beliefs are always still recognizable. Yet to read Montaigne is to experience a series of shocks of familiarity, which makes the centuries between him and the 21st century reader collapse to nothing. Keep seeing yourself in him, just as visitors to the Oxford Muse see themselves, or aspects of themselves in the story of why an educated Russian works as a cleaner, or of what it's like to prefer not to dance. As we face each other in omnibuses and underground railways, we are looking into the mirror. And the novelist in future will realize more and more the importance of these reflections. for of course there is not one reflection, but an almost infinite number. Those are the depths we will explore. Montaigne was the first writer to create literature that deliberately worked in this way, and to do it using the plentiful material of his own life rather than pure philosophy or pure invention. Now I see the witching hour is coming. So I hope you'll come back and spend some time with me. In the meantime, here's a little bit of music that will soothe the soul. Bye for now.
someone give his heart. Someone who cares like me.
damn hippies. Brethren, thanks for joining me again today. You know, we put it all in context. Well, I should do a paper on the hippie movement. Oh, my goodness. They all grew up, got into decent jobs, learned that they could dress up and get a haircut, had something to offer, and actually went from being this heavily criticized to being drivers, accelerating everything, working, you know, extreme work weeks, craving success. Who knew? Who knew? I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the